Good evening and welcome. I'm Kelly Richards, CEO of the All Access Group and the host of All Access Radio. As a highly sought-after consultant, super connector, trusted advisor, and thought leader, I connect innovators and influencers from Silicon Valley to Hollywood to Madison Avenue. As a trusted advisor, I transform the quality of people's lives and their work. And I'm also the author of the best-selling ebook, The Magic and Moxie of Apple, An Insider's View. Tonight's guest on the show is Tom Kiefer, best known as the singer, songwriter, and guitarist of Philadelphia-based blues rock band Cinderella. Tom is one of rock's leading frontmen. With three decades of touring and a number of platinum albums under his belt, including Night Songs, Long Cold Winter, and Heartbreak Station, Tom has evolved as a musician, writer, and performer over the years, as best showcased on his debut solo release, The Way Life Goes, which was released back in 2013. And this collection of 14 songs ranges from intimate, organic, acoustic tracks to driving hard rock. It embraces the blues, rock, and country roots that have always been present in Tom's unique sound. Tom has recently been featured on Loudwire, VH1 on Tap, Billboard, Sixth Sense, Guitar Player Magazine, Fox, and he's been hailed by Rolling Stone as a gritsy, bluesy rocker with enough swagger to draw comparisons to Mick Jagger. Welcome to the show, Tom.
Hello, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. It's great to have you.
Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. I know you've been very busy lately, and we're going to get into that in just a minute. But the first question I'd like to ask you, Tom, is the notion of having a trusted advisor, you know, including a mentor as part of that description. It's so important. I wonder if you can share with our listeners who have been some of your mentors along the way and whether you've ever mentored others yourself.
Yeah, well, when you mentioned trusted advisor and mentor, they can sometimes be the same thing and sometimes be different. You know, I think the inner circle, where you have trusted advisors, where you're making decisions and that kind of thing. You know, probably my closest trusted advisor is my wife Savannah, in that sense. And I would say that Tim Heine, my manager, who's been my manager now since 1998, is also falls into that category. And you know, that's a circle there where you're making, you know, important decisions, and it's people who, as you know, just as the phrase says, that you trust and respect their opinions and advice and that kind of thing. So Savannah's certainly the closest, and Tim, my manager. As far as mentors, there's one person that comes to mind for me as a mentor, because I learned so much musically from him, and that was my first producer, Andy Johns, who produced the early Cinderella records. And he was somebody who taught me so much about the procedure of producing an album and capturing, you know, up until that point, we would go and play our music live, and then when you go into the studio, it's a very different, it's a challenge to capture that live.
Yes.
And I learned about that from Andy, and I learned everything about production and counterpoint and instrumentation. So there was so much growth from the time I met Andy to, you know, through the few records that we worked together. So I consider him probably my greatest mentor in that sense.
And by the way, you're very lucky to have a relationship like that, Tom, with a producer. That relationship can be, obviously, as you know, one of the best, most important, you know, creative experiences of collaboration, or a complete disaster. So you were very fortunate to have something like that with Andy.
Yes, it can be, and I learned so much from him. So I kind of put him in the mentor category, because to me, mentoring is more about you're learning from somebody more than anything.
Sure.
And certainly he was the biggest. And in terms of, you know, I don't think I've really mentored anyone, and not in the way that Andy, not in the sense like that Andy was to me. I'm sure people have learned things from me who've worked with me, or, you know, but I can't think of anyone that I've just mentored in that way.
Yep. Understood. Well, 2015 has certainly been filled with touring and festival appearances for you in support of The Way Life Goes. I believe you were just getting ready to go out on the tour when we last crossed paths in Nashville at the Pollstar Awards. So tell us how the tour has been going.
It's been great. We actually, I think our tour started just a few weeks after that, in that very building where we met at the City
right.
Winery was our opening night for the tour. And from there, and that was great. It was a really fun venue to play and sold out and really a great way to kick off the tour. And we went from there to the Monsters of Rock cruise, which is the first year I've done with my solo band, and that was a blast. And we've just been, you know, out doing shows ever since, you know. And it's just great. I mean, I love this band. I can't say it enough. It's so cool to be out playing, you know, not only the Cinderella material, but the stuff off of this new record. And there's just a whole new energy being out there with a new record and a new band. And it's, simply put, it's just great. It's going great.
I think a lot of people don't understand the dynamics between artists and fans during a show and during a tour. And, you know, it's one of these intangible things that I guess unless you're the performer, it's kind of hard to express. But I'd like you to try to express what the energy is like and why it's so invigorating between you and the fans when you're on stage.
Well, for me, playing live is my favorite part of what I do in terms of, you know, the music. Creating it is one aspect that, you know, I love doing that, but that can sometimes be challenging, frustrating. Live is like, it is what it is. There's no do-overs. It's a real moment. And you're sharing that with people who the music has affected their lives, and in turn, they're affecting your life. And it's a bond that's only shared between, you know, musicians and fans, or, you know, however you want to say that. And it's just, I just feel that they give their all at those shows. You know, they sing the words, all the words at the top of their lungs every night.
Yeah.
They're so into it. And it's, you know, I feel lucky every time I walk on that stage after 30 years, you know, and it's continuing now with my solo project that I walk out there and they're still showing up. They're still singing the songs. And that just makes me want to give them everything I have on that stage every night.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, it's a reciprocating energy in
yeah.
that sense. And
yeah.
it gets, you know, it gets intense, you know, every show you go out there and you can feel it at the beginning of the show and it just grows and grows and grows. And by the end of the show, it's just, you know, very intense.
Well, you know, it's your gift. Both sides of it, the songwriting and the performing. But, you know, when you have that gift, it's almost an obligation to get out there and engage with those folks who have basically made your career and who embrace it and love it so much.
And I never forget that. And
yeah.
So, you know, I've always been, even back in the 80s when it was all about party, party, party. And, you know, I wasn't that guy because I always wanted to be 120% when I walked on that stage every night.
Yeah.
So that was always important to me because I truly feel grateful for the gift that I've been given of the success that I've had and the amazing fans and people who have supported the music that I've been involved with over the years. Just, you know, I can't do anything else but give them everything I have.
It's fantastic. Now, what do you think the music on this album is trying to say about the way life goes? What did you intend to express?
Well, you know, it's interesting. That title, we didn't have a title for the record the whole time we were making it. And that, you know, the record was in the works for 9 years. And actually, that title came about because there was a song called that, which ultimately ended up being the title track, as we say in the business.
Right.
And so, you know, we were actually compiling the lyrics and the credits and proofreading them, Savannah and I, right here in our living room. And it's different when you listen to the lyrics coming out of a speaker with the music and all, and when you actually read them. So we're reading them just to proofread them, and they're really sinking in. And at one point we just looked at each other and we're like, man, this record is so full of real life experiences and emotions and the uncertainty of life and how sometimes things don't work out the way we want, but there's a silver lining. And there's, you know, there's so much of that within this record. And that one song, The Way Life Goes, that title just seemed to sum up the whole record. Because
yeah.
I do think it's full of real experiences, real emotions, not always ones that I've gone through as a writer, or Savannah, or some of the other writers on the record. But, you know, a lot of times when as a writer, it's observation, too.
Absolutely.
But it's all real things, you know, that have been felt. So, I think it's about, it covers so many aspects of life.
It does. And is there a favorite track on the solo album that you feel really captures that spirit, the one that you particularly love to perform the most?
Well, it's hard to pick a favorite track because I've always liked to make records that are a journey in terms of dynamics and instrumentation, and this record's no exception to that. You know, there's acoustic tracks, there's mid-tempo tracks, there's really hard and heavy tracks, and, you know, everything in between. So you kind of like different tracks for different reasons. As far as playing live, I love doing Solid Ground live. That's a really great live track, and we've been doing that since this band went out on the road when the record was first released. That was in the set, and I love playing that one live. So for a live pick, that one's cool. I also like playing a different light live, too, because it's just a very different feeling track, and it's as different as it is, it really draws. You can see the people because of the lyrics and all in that song. You can really see people really pay attention to that song live, and it's kind of cool to be able to play something that's a little bit different, and it doesn't go over like a Led Zeppelin.
And likewise, I have to say, I think my personal favorite's the Flowers song. Maybe for a lot of women, that's their favorite track on the CD.
Yeah. Well, guys, too, you know, because it's a song for people who, you know, it's about soulmates and true love, and, you know, it's cool. You know, you look out at the audience when we're playing that one, and people who are there together, they just start putting their arms around each other. You know, it's a romantic moment. So, I've always been a sucker for that kind of thing, you know, ballads and that kind of thing, and I'm a big Rod Stewart fan, so that kind of more romantic rock side I've always liked, so I like that lyric a lot. That is actually one of my favorite songs on the record.
Here we go, and of course that's a good segue. I understand, you know, I know that your wife Savannah has been instrumental in co-writing the tracks on the album, and I wonder what it was like for you guys to create together, given the fact you're also husband and wife.
Oh, it's amazing because, you know, we work very well together. There's two different kinds of writers. They're the ones that have like a stopwatch and like schedule and bum bum, you know, got to get it done today. Let's schedule it for tomorrow. And, you know, we're going to write a hit single on Wednesday. And neither one of us are that kind of writer.
Right.
It's got to come from, you know, if we lived in a house together and one of us was that way and the other one wasn't, we'd probably kill each other.
Yeah.
And we would probably never write anything. So we both approach it where, you feel something, you get a few lines, you get a melody, you take it to the other, you know, we take it to each other when we have that, and, you know, the other one either feels it or doesn't, and then we sit down and start working on it, and if we get X amount of way into it, we don't force trying to finish it. A Different Light is a great example, because we wrote that song over a period of probably a year and a half.
Mm.
Just keep coming back to it.
Yeah.
So, and, you know, I think we ended up with something kind of special that way. And, you know, if we'd had, like, if one of us had been a we need to finish this today kind of writer, you know, we may not have ended up where we were. So that's the beauty of us working together, is we don't care how long it takes. Obviously, the record took 9 years.
Yeah.
So. You know, but I mean, that's, you know, that's kind of how I've always worked. And Savannah's the same way. And she also co-produced the record with Chuck Turner and I.
Yes.
And we weren't in any hurry, because the record really started out as not even a record. It started out as we were all kind of in a bad place with the, shall we say, the music industry and some experiences we had recently.
No kidding.
And, yeah, so we just wanted to make some music with no labels involved or lawyers or any of that kind of nonsense. So it just started off as coming out in our studio where I'm standing right now. I'm looking at this console that we did all this on. And, let's just record a song, you know. And we'd record it and get away from it for a while and go write another one and come work on it. And we kind of did it off and on like that, like a labor of love. I would take long breaks from it. And go on tour with Cinderella, and you know, and it just came together over a period of 9 years, and somewhere halfway through that or so, it started feeling like, hey, maybe we have an album here.
Yeah.
That's really where it came together. So so you have really have to have like-minded people to be able to work that way.
And again, it's different with Savannah, of course, being with you all the time, because you guys could be out grocery shopping and somebody think of a line to a song, or you could be on vacation or having a cup of tea and going, I just got the bridge for that.
Yeah, and
you
that's
know,
happened.
I mean,
that's actually happened. That's a good point. That has happened. Actually, the key change, I'll tell you, the key change really quick in a different light, there's that weird kind of guitar that segues into the chorus, and it changes the key. It's a very odd key change. It goes from E to B flat.
Yeah.
And originally, the song was all in the same key, and it just wasn't going anywhere, and we weren't that excited about it. And we went out to a club. I think it was my birthday. And it was a place here in town called the Voodoo Lounge, and they were playing a whole bunch of old 80s new wave and dance music, like Thomas Dolby and like Crowded House. And like we're just sitting there drinking and listening to all this crazy music from the 80s, which was very innovative music.
And also, noticed, by the way, all of those bands were out at the same time you had your big Cinderella success initially.
Yeah, exactly. And I always loved all that kind of music, too. I thought the production stuff was very colorful. So we're listening to all these songs, and we noticed how often they change keys throughout the song, just crazy cold key changes.
Oh, yeah.
And we looked at each other, and we were like, maybe we should just put some, like, crazy cold key change in a different light.
Yeah.
And that's how it happened. So it's like you said, we were out somewhere, and we got an idea, and that just made the song come to life.
Yeah. And the whole part about it taking as long as it took. I mean, Todd Rundgren and I may have told you this before when we were having our own conversation, but Todd and I built a platform 20 years ago now to help artists go direct to their fans and to be able to liberate themselves from labels and take as long as they wanted to put an album together. And it took a long while for that concept to catch on. The only group I knew of at the time that was doing that was Def Leppard, who would take, you know, 3 and 4 years between albums, and people would always, you know, laugh at them because of that. But, you know, nowadays it's a 180. Artists are liberated, like you have been, to take your time and put it together the way you want to and control everything yourselves. You're not beholden to a label.
Yeah, that's what we did during the production end of it. But then once we had it produced, we didn't really want to be in the business of being the record company. So we actually shopped the finished product, but we got to make the record on our own terms.
Right.
And I think that that's a better way to do it, because then also the labels ultimately get to hear the finished work. So they're either excited about it or they're not. You know, the idea of going in with like really crappy demos and a label signing you, and then they hire a producer and spend a whole bunch of money and hope that it's the right producer and we're going to end up with something magic, is a whole lot, it's a much bigger decision to make than having a finished record come in where they can actually listen to it and go, I either love this or I don't.
I'll say. And then, of course, you know, you've got more negotiating leverage to retain your rights because all of that's behind you.
Yeah, and we found an amazing label, Merivee Records, who signed it, and they just were so excited about the record from day one, and I think the reason they were is because they were able to hear the finished thing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So.
Yeah. And by the way,
and likewise, there were labels who were not very excited about it.
Well, and you wouldn't have wanted to work with them anyway.
Right, and you know, it sorts it out quicker, right?
I'll say, better to have the people behind you that really are behind you.
Right.
Now, obviously, the release of this album was a huge triumph for you, Tom, and we all remember what happened at the peak of Cinderella's success when you lost your voice. I almost hesitate to bring it up, but I think it was a turning point for you for so many reasons. Can you share a little bit about what you went through mentally and emotionally to go from you know, allegedly the peak of your career to being told you would never sing again?
Yeah, well, it was. I mean, it was right at the end of the Heartbreak Station tour.
Right.
And the first two records, you know, millions of records sold, and Heartbreak Station went platinum. Really, like almost overnight, and was really critically acclaimed. And we were out on this big tour, and all of a sudden, my voice just like stopped working. And luckily, there was only a couple weeks left in the tour, and I kind of just squeaked my way through the tour. But it literally was overnight. So a very long story short, that turned into a search for what was going on. And I went to a bunch of doctors, and they said, you know, with their standard scopes down the throat, they couldn't see anything wrong. Like, they couldn't see any of the normal or, you know, things that you would normally see in a rock singer, like polyps or nodes or something growing on the cords that they can just laser off.
Right.
There wasn't any of that. And they were like, we don't know what's wrong with your voice. So long story short, I went to every doctor, which doctor, everyone I can imagine. And finally, a doctor ran a neurological test and said, you have your left vocal cord is partly paralyzed.
Mm.
And that's not something that's easily seen on a scope, because the vibrations are so fast that, you know, you have to run a neurological test to really catch that. They can't, you know, it's not always that easy to detect visually.
Well, luckily, that's somebody did.
Yeah, well, luckily, but there's no cure for it. So I was told I'd never sing again, and most people who get this don't ever sing again.
Right.
And without naming anybody, there's actually some very big famous singers that you don't hear from too much anymore who actually this is the reason why.
Exactly.
So it's, you know, it was devastating. But initially I was in denial because I didn't want to think that I had something that couldn't be cured. And he told me that my only prayer of singing again would be to try to work with speech pathologists and vocal coaches and try and retrain the cord to work properly. And he said, it's not an exact science and there's no guarantee you're going to be able to do it. And even if you do, your voice could be really different from how it was. And basically just told me, you know, you're probably done. So initially I went into denial and didn't want to accept his diagnosis and kept going to other doctors trying to find something else wrong, and there wasn't anything else wrong. He was right. So then I started buckling down and working with coaches, and it's just taken me years, you know, and it's been very up and down. I've worked with every vocal coach on the planet, speech pathologist. I've tried, you know, all kinds of alternative things from, you know, acupuncture and acupressure and, you know, just, you know, every approach you can think of, even energy healers and, you know, to try and stimulate that neurological activity again. And but I've, you know, the good news is in recent years, through trial and error and working with different coaches and getting bits and pieces of knowledge from different coaches and trying to learn how to place that sound again and try to make strengthen that cord, my voice is really strong again. And, you know, I thank God for that, because it's something that, and the condition's still there. It'll always be there. So I have to, I do about an hour and a half every day of vocal warm-ups and exercises, even if I have a show, to keep it in place. But, I mean, getting back to, what I went through emotionally, it was devastating.
Of course.
On top of it, it was right around that 90s period where the whole industry was kind of kicking 80s rock bands to the curb, and it was out with the old and then with the new.
The grunge.
Yeah, and you know, everybody, you know, I felt like I wanted to fight and say, hey, you know, I still want to make music, obviously, but my instrument, I felt like my instrument was taken away from me. So It was kind of like two things at once going on that were really devastating to, you know. On one hand, you got the industry saying, you know, you guys aren't cool anymore. And it's like, well, I'll show you I'm cool. And it's like, well, wait a minute. I don't have a voice. How am I going to do that?
That's right.
So that was kind of hard to, you know, to kind of square that in my mind, too. So it was awful, you know. I mean, depression and, you know, there was a period in the mid-90s where I was probably going to, a lot of therapy every day to talk about it. And it was rough.
Well, the good news is you not only survived it, you thrived through it on the other side. So, you know, you battled it out and you got to the other side.
Yeah, it's, I just couldn't see myself doing anything else. I think that's what drove me to, you know, just keep working every day and chipping away. And it was frustrating because it's the kind of thing, you know, I'd make a couple steps forward and then I'd feel like, wow, I'm really getting there, but it's, you know, a neurological condition is something that doesn't go away. So
it's an
inherent weakness that will be in there forever. So it was a challenge to really figure out how to get around it and make that cord function properly.
Kudos to you for prevailing through all that, Tom. I can only imagine.
Well, thank you.
And, you know, for everybody's benefit, especially yours, you, as I say, you've prevailed and you continue to work with it. So you're doing great. I'm curious if you can share a little bit what it's been like to tour and sing with Cinderella again, obviously on and off over the years. Do you have any memories that stand out, perhaps during and since the 20th anniversary tour, Rock Never Stops? Obviously.
Well, actually, the 20th anniversary tour with Rock Never Stops was the tour just before the 20th anniversary tour. I believe Rock Never Stops was 2005, and then the 20th anniversary was 2006.
There you go. Okay.
So I think the longest period we went without touring was between Still Climbing and 98, when I would refer to the 98 tour as a reunion tour, because I think we toured for Still Climbing briefly in the early 90s, and then we... the kind of the wheels just fell off everything and we drifted apart. And I moved to Nashville in 97 with the idea of making a solo record. And shortly after that, the band reformed and started touring again in 98. So, and we had tours off and on every couple of years, pretty much since then, up until I released my solo record. So, I mean, you know, the generally speaking, well, the 20th anniversary tour was really fun. We were doing a big amphitheater and arena tour with Poison. That tour was a blast. Definitely a highlight. You know, everything with Cinderella was just, you know, from day one, the release of the record was just like a magic ride, you know?
Yeah.
It's, I always describe it as like this tornado came down and picked us up and took us on this ride that was just going so fast, you just hung on, you just tried to hang on.
Yeah.
And it was amazing. And it's hard to pick, you know, certainly that 20th anniversary tour was cool because that happened after the whole demise or decline in the 90s. You know, we'd started touring again towards the end of the 90s, and we built our brand back up where we were back touring amphitheaters and arenas again. You know, we didn't think we were ever going to be able to do that again. So those few tours that we did in that time period where we kind of came back, that was a big deal for us. It really felt amazing after what we went through in the 90s.
Well, and of course, to reinforce that you did have a legion of fans globally that never stopped caring and being passionate about you guys.
Well, yeah. I mean, that music just stopped being served, you know.
That's right.
I mean, those fans are still there. They're still there now. I mean, you know, we're going out with the solo band, and, you know, they're coming around to that. And,
sure.
You know, because they want to hear those songs, and they want to hear the new stuff. You know, most of them are into the solo record now, too. And so it's like a whole new life again with that. But, yeah, it's just been an amazing ride. I hope I answered your question.
No, you did, Tom. And, you know, I was... talk of Poison and the crews, the rock crews and stuff, where they're packaging groups like you guys again.
Yeah.
I happened to catch, I've had interactions with Kip Winger over the years, and I happened to, just for whatever reason, something struck me. You know, when you go into the YouTube and you go down a rabbit hole, that happened over the weekend, and I watched a couple of the Winger videos again, those big videos, about the same time you guys were first taking off. And,
right.
And I found, you know, a little fun fact about Paul Taylor touring with you guys at one point with Cinderella, you know, last few years.
Yeah, well, he's out with my solo band now.
Oh, there you go. Even better.
Yeah, he's been with this band from the beginning when we first started touring.
And
he toured with Cinderella the tour the year just before I started my solo thing. He came in and was playing keyboards in 2012, I think it was, with Cinderella.
There you go. And so you see this cross-pollination that goes on from you guys
yeah.
to all been around for the same amount of time, same general genre, you know, and now the cruises come up where bands can play together and you're all old friends and same kind of fans, and I just think that's really powerful too, collectively.
Yeah, the cruises are a lot of fun, really
yeah.
a lot of fun.
I've not been on one, but I'm thinking about going on one, and come to find out, I found out you were on your cruise when you were on it, and some friends of mine, Bill, went on it too. And said, oh, yeah, you know, we were there. And I was, oh, geez.
Well, the end of January, we're on a very cool one. It's the Def Leppard cruise, Hysteria
yes.
on the High Seas. It's like the end of January. So I'm on that with my solo band.
I think they just announced it, tickets on sale recently. And
yeah.
for our listeners, check that out. That's going to be a pretty great lineup. I even think the Winger guys are on there, too. But
yeah.
I'm planning to go. I mean, I'd like to go. I haven't made plans yet, so it ought to be a lot of fun.
Yeah, now, I think that's going to be a fun one.
Another last Cinderella question that I, not a question, but I, well, yeah, it is a question. It's a fun fact for our listeners in the trivia category again. I don't know that a lot of people realize that you were actually discovered, the band was, by John Bon Jovi at the Empire Rock Club in Philly back in 1985.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder, you know, he's really the A&R guy, right, that discovered you. And I wonder what he said when he came up to you after that fateful show.
Well, he came in, he didn't say much, really, you know. And we knew who he was because Runaway was a hit on MTV.
Right.
And, you know, we were just getting started in the clubs. We'd been together for a couple of years and making demos and stuff. And he was in town recording his second record, 7,800 degrees Fahrenheit. And he just walked back into the dressing room at the Empire, introduced himself, and we were, you know, a little bit starstruck. We were like, oh, that's that guy from MTV, you know, kind of, you know, cool for us.
Yeah.
And he just said he really liked the show and hung out for a few minutes and left. And a few days later, we got a call from our manager, and he said that, you know, that guy John Bon Jovi, I know that sounds funny now to say because he's, you know, but at that time it was kind of, was that guy John Bon Jovi, you know?
Yeah.
Because he was actually just getting started too, you know, he just had his, he
sure.
had his first
I mean, not
hit.
Even These Three Went Out When Wet was out yet. I think
that wasn't out yet. So, the manager said, you know, that guy John, you know, he was really impressed with your show, and he went back to Polygram and was talking you up to the A&R guy. And the reason my manager knew that was because the A&R guy already had our demo tape from our manager.
Ah.
And he was riding the fence because our demos were just awful. You know, like I said, before Andy Johns, we knew nothing about how to record and how to produce music. You know, that's a learning curve, and we were pretty young. So admittedly, our demos were terrible. The A&R guy, Derek Shulman, was really riding the fence. And basically what John did was he walked in and said, I just saw this band. And Derek said, I wasn't there, but this is what I'm told was said. I have the demo. I don't know. I'm not sold. And apparently John said, forget the demo. Go and see them live.
Yeah.
So those were the famous words that were uttered.
Amazing.
And Derek did come down, and in true A&R guy fashion, still wasn't convinced. And he signed us to a 6-month developmental deal at that point, and made us write more songs. And you know, he put it through our paces before he signed us, but he eventually signed us. So.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think you know.
And
I
John was very supportive. John was very supportive after that too. He ended up taking us on the Slippery When Wet tour. The Night Songs had come out and was really starting to take off. And when they were releasing Slippery When Wet and planning the tour, they put us on as the opening act. So.
Yeah. And do you guys stay in touch, you and John, to this day?
I haven't talked to him in a couple of years. It's been a few years. He came through here in Nashville and did a show a few years ago. And it's the last time I've been in touch with him.
Well, it all comes around. That's a phenomenal story, and I love the fact that he was really on top of it and just right place, right time, right? That's an example of that.
Well, you know, that's you know, kind of how things happen, right? You're in the right place. There's a lot of luck. There's a lot of stars aligning, right? And I think, you know, if you've done your homework, then maybe it'll work out for you, right?
It's the way life goes. I love it.
Yeah, thank you. There you go.
So getting back to the present, the solo tour continues throughout 2015, or at least for a little while longer, and I'm hoping you're going to come to the West Coast. Any plans for a West Coast leg?
Yeah, we have actually we're going to be out there a couple of times. The one that I can speak of right now is we're doing the Cat House Live at Irvine Meadows.
Okay.
Which is August, I believe. And I would say go to tomkiefer.com so I don't say the wrong date.
Exactly.
But the Cat House Live is a big festival that's being held at Irvine Meadows. And then there's another festival that I cannot announce yet that's going to be in September that's in Northern California. So we'll be coming out to California at least twice this year.
I will certainly try to catch that show. That looks fantastic. Well, Tom, you've been very generous with your time. I like to wrap up always asking my guests this one last question. I don't know if you can answer it yet. It's basically, you know, what comes next for you
that you dream about creating as part of your legacy? Last time I asked you that question in Nashville a few months ago, you said, well, I'm very focused on the tour. And I imagine you might have the same answer, but I'd like to ask it again.
Well, I am very focused on the tour. We have a lot more dates this year. There's going to be a lot more being posted up on the website very soon, actually. There's been a lot of things in the works. And we're looking at things for next year, too, the tour, because we've just been having a great, like I said, with this band and touring behind this record and also playing all the Cinderella stuff, we're just having a great time. And we don't see any reason to go home because the record took so long.
Yeah.
So, you know, being out behind it for, you know, a couple of years here touring just seems to make sense. So, but that said, I there will be some new music. I started writing last year a little bit. I started kind of feeling that inspiration again because as much time as we spent on this record, I needed a break from that for a while.
I bet.
So started working on that. I'm starting to feel that energy flow again. And I haven't dove into the deep end of writing just yet, but the good news is I've got my foot in the water. So it shouldn't be long, you know, and I definitely want to do another record. And, you know, so that's coming. That's what I got my sights set on down the road. But in the immediate future here, we're just having a good time touring.
Do you think you'll tour internationally at all?
Yes, we will.
Good. Excellent.
For sure. Probably before the end of the year.
You got fans globally. We know that. So,
yeah.
So thanks again, Tom. It's been a real treat to have a chance to catch up with you on all this. And I wish you the very best on the continued tour. And again, I hope to catch you at the show in Northern California when that's announced.
Yes, that's going to be a good one. And the one in Irvine Meadows is going to be a blast. There's a lot of great bands on that bill.
For all our listeners who are Tom and Cinderella fans, do check Tom's site, tomkiefer.com, for all the details. And thanks again for being here, Tom. It's been a real pleasure.
Thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, and I do want to thank my show producer, as I do every week, Jessica Mastors, who does a wonderful job, and our great listeners. We'll hear you all again next week on the next edition of All Access Radio. Good night, everybody.